It's time now for America in the Balance. Brought to you by Oklahomans for Sovereignty and Free Enterprise. And now your co-hosts, Amanda Teagarden and Don Wyatt.
And welcome, freedom-loving Oklahomans, to another hour of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. This is Amanda Teagarden in studio with my co-host, Don Wyatt. Hi, Don.
Hi, how you doing? It's great to see you, and it's nice to wish you and all of our audience a very happy new year. We have finally reached 2012.
We have, what a momentous time this is in our country's history. 2012.
Turning point, I hope.
Remember when we were younger and that seemed so far away?
It sure, so did 2000. I remember the Y2K problem. Lived through that in the computer business.
We're going to have a very interesting year in 2012.
I'm afraid so, and I hope so.
We are broadcasting from the state of Oklahoma and the city of Tulsa. And our website, by the way, boy, you can tell this is a brand new year. Starting, we haven't recorded.
A little rusty already, aren't we?
Where are we? 2012, broadcasting from Oklahoma. The website is ok-safe.com. That's ok-safe.com. There's a new website that's out there that's under construction, but you can go out and check it now if you'd like. It's exposinghealthcarereform.com, which is about one subject, and it's the OK Safe effort to explain their real meaning of healthcare reform, what the public calls Obamacare.
And while that may still be under construction, I encourage people to take a look at it because there's already some really excellent content there.
It'll be beginning. And what's happening in Oklahoma, we can guarantee you, is taking place in your state as well. And the hope is that that website becomes a template that other states can use to examine, to fight healthcare reform in their state.
Right.
And Don, you have Boondoggle Blog?
Boondoggleblog.com is another website that we encourage people to keep an eye on. We're constantly on the lookout for inappropriate use of our public monies. The subtitle, by the way, is Useless Work Paid For with Public Money. And so that's what we think a boondoggle is, and we have a lot of information that we post out there. And every time we get involved in a new cause, it doesn't take long to do the trace of the money and discover that there's another boondoggle candidate there.
When you're talking about government waste of money, I think that's a little repetitive.
It is. It's redundant.
It is redundant. We are fortunate to have as our guest today Michael Bednarik, who is considered a constitutional scholar, is a constitutional scholar and the author of a book called Good to Be King. And the title is very intriguing. And he will be discussing an upcoming class on the U.S. Constitution to be held in Oklahoma City at the state capitol, Don, on the floor of the House.
Right. And I'm excited about that. I really am.
And it's hosted by Charles Key and Kay Beach of Axiom for Liberty. And it will be taking place on Saturday, January 14th, 2012, in on the floor of the House of Representatives.
That's right.
And there is a cost associated with it, which you can go to the OK Safe blog.
Right.
At just go to the website ok-safe.com, click on the blog link, and you'll see the details there. Scroll down to the U.S. Constitution class. And you can also go to Axiom for Liberty's website, that's two X's in Axiom, and see the details there about Michael Bednarik coming. And it's an introduction to the Constitution class. It's an 8-hour class, and a lot of people should be very interested in attending this, especially the elected officials.
I wish they would, but I fear they won't.
Well, we can encourage them to attend. And without further ado, Michael, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks so much for having me on today.
Well, thank you very much for being our guest. And, let's answer the phone. We're going to put our phones on silent.
It is a new year. I'm sorry. That was mine. I'll fess up.
It is the beginning of 2012. Let's, all right. And Michael, please tell us about a little bit about yourself, the book Good to Be King, and what people can expect to hear and learn at the Introduction to the Constitution class.
I started studying the Constitution 30 years ago. My first conclusion was that most of what the government does is unconstitutional, and I immediately went into denial. I mean, that certainly could not be true, not in the great United States of America. The more I studied, the more I realized that it was true. 12 years ago, I started teaching an 8-hour class on the Constitution that really rocks people's world. When I give speeches, I will occasionally ask the audience to raise their hand if they are good, patriotic Americans. Not surprisingly, everybody in the audience will raise their hand. The second question is to please raise your hand if you can tell me how many articles are in the Constitution. And sadly, very few people can answer that question.
How many articles are there in the Constitution?
There are seven.
Seven, thank you.
The first three are the most important because they explicitly define the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of the federal government. Most people have heard somewhere that there is a separation of powers, or at least there's supposed to be. And that's why Articles 1, 2, and 3 define and establish the legislative, executive, and judicial branches, respectively. Now, when people come to my class, I let them know that I'm going to rattle their cage. Most of what they think that they know about the Constitution and their government is wrong. And I'm able to demonstrate that in the first half hour. And we focus on fundamentals. I mean, philosophical fundamentals. We really don't even get to the Constitution itself until just after lunch. First question is, why do we have any government at all? Especially today with so many people angry and disappointed with government. I mean, if we're angry with government, let's just get rid of it. We'll just eliminate government completely. We'll have anarchy. And the audience goes crazy. And it's like, oh my God, we can't have anarchy. I said, well, okay, let's have some form of government. How about communism? How about socialism? Most of the countries in the world are either socialist or communist. All those countries can't be wrong, can they? You know, 1.5 billion Chinese people? They must really like communism. Well, most Americans get really uneasy at the thought of having communism here in the United States. And so we analyze why there should be any government at all. It's not a difficult question. The question is answered by the second paragraph in the Declaration of Independence, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. I mean, how much of the government that we have you consented to? And the answer is most of us haven't consented to any of it.
Or not much of it anyway, for sure.
Or not much of it. And so, you know, people are frustrated. They're angry with the economy. They're angry with our political status. They know that something is desperately wrong, but I mean, they're really not capable of fixing the problem because they don't know what the source of the problem is.
Yeah, it's hard to know where to begin to unravel it and where it started to go wrong to begin with.
It's, to create a metaphor, it's a little bit like being lost in the forest. If you are lost in the forest, you know that you are cold, wet, and hungry, and that you would really like to be home. But if you don't know where home is, you're just going to continue to be lost in the forest. And the knowledge that you need to have is basically you need to have a map to see where you are now, and you need to have a compass so that you can point yourself in a straight line between where you're standing and where you would like to be.
That's right.
The problem is people go, well, wait a minute, that's going to lead directly through that swamp. I don't want to get my shoes muddy. You go, well, okay, so you want to just stay here lost in the forest. Well, no. Okay, so you get to pick one. You can either be lost in the forest or you can get your shoes muddy in the swamp and eventually get home. You know, that, you know, your choice.
That's a good analogy, because what you're saying is the fix will come with some discomfort.
Yes. Oh, absolutely, there's going to be discomfort, especially with as far as we have allowed the tyranny to go.
Right.
That one of the reasons that it's going to be difficult to fix the problem is that as our fellow Americans wake up to the problem, they're not going to believe how bad it really is.
That's a really valid point.
They are in denial. And they don't want to hear it. You know, if you go up to somebody, you know, a friend of yours, and say, hey, I really hate to be the bearer of bad news, but, you know, your significant other is cheating on you. They're not going to say, oh, thank you for coming to me with this information. Now I can make it all right. What's their first reaction? Their first reaction is to call you a liar. You know, their relationship is similar to Romeo and Juliet. It's going to last forever. You are flat out wrong. Oh, my gosh, how could you even suggest such a thing?
Anger is usually the first response in grief anyway, isn't it?
That's right. And so you can show them 8x10 glossy pictures, and they're going to insist that was all Photoshop. Now, why do people have such a strong denial reflex? Well, because if the information you are giving them is correct, life is going to be miserable.
That's right.
You know, in this particular hypothesis, you know, you're going to have to, one, you've been emotionally betrayed by somebody that you love. Then you're going to have to spend money and time with the lawyers trying to divide up the property. You know, you get the house, I get the car, you get the kids, I get the dog, all of that. I mean, your life will be changed forever, and it's going to be very painful.
That's right.
And so at the very beginning, instead of acknowledging that this is the process that you're going to have to go through, it's much easier to be in denial. No, not my significant other. Well, the same thing is true with our political problems.
Yeah, the analogy is good there, too, because the fix in our political problems isn't going to be instantaneous either, is it?
And it's going to be painful. It's going to be really painful. I'm living in the Chicago area where I grew up, and, well, we haven't had a lot of snow, but it's starting to get cold. And I'm already remembering back to my childhood when I would be out in the snow all day and your hands are so cold that your fingers are numb. I mean, you can't unzip your jacket because your fingers are so numb. And so you come into the warm house, and as your fingers start to warm up and as the blood starts to circulate again, which is a good thing,
It hurts.
It's like, ow, 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 this hurts.
It burns.
The good news, the pain indicates that something is finally happening.
If it continued to
be painless, you would eventually have frostbite and the doctor would be cutting your fingers off your hand.
That's right.
So, yeah, there's going to be denial that people, I mean, don't believe the problem is as bad as it is. There's going to be resistance to the cure, but it's going to happen.
Have you found in your experience that most people believe that when they were young, regardless of what their current age is, but when they were young, the country was in good shape, so that a 20-year-old thinks that the country back in the 90s was in good shape? Do you see my question?
I do see the question. It's going to be kind of hard to answer because I usually don't have 20-year-old kids talking to me. I'm usually the old fart in the crowd, and, you know, they don't want to hang out with me.
It just occurred to me that might help explain why we see such a noticeable disparity between the political opinions and reactions and responses that are generational defined, and it could be that everybody thinks that it should be now the way it was when they were young. I'm not sure.
Well, it also explains why we have this perpetual problem. I mean, the adage is that if you don't study history, then you're doomed to repeat it.
That's right.
And the problem is nobody studies history, especially young people. You know, when I was in high school, history class was just sitting around talking about old times. And it didn't make any sense to me. I mean, like, who cares what they did in 1775? You know, so a bunch of guys got into a scuffle with the local, you know, army. Who cares? Well, now, I mean, I kind of believe that, at least emotionally, I was there at Lexington and Concord.
I understand your point, too. Yep. That's right.
So, you know, when you have teenage children, you say, look, don't do this because you're going to be really disappointed. You're going to get your heart broken. Do they follow our advice? Do they say, thanks, Dad, you really helped save me? Of course not. Your dad, your mom, what could you possibly know? You guys are old timers. You don't even listen to the same music I listen to.
That's right.
And so they go off and they do the same mistakes that we made when we were their age and that our parents were trying to warn us about, but we thought we were too smart to listen. I mean, it's just a human psychology problem. So, you know, nothing is obvious. Absolutely nothing is obvious. You and I know that when you're walking through the kitchen, it's not a good idea to put your hand on the stove because it's a possibility that the stove is hot and you can, you know, really come away with a burn. Okay? But hot is a concept that is only obvious until after you have your first blister. If you have a toddler in the kitchen, is curious about what mom is doing up there on top of the stove, you know, the toddler is reaching his hand up onto the stove to try to grab something off the top of the stove.
That's right.
And mom says, don't touch, hot. And the child will recoil, you know, kind of in fear. Well, did the child recoil because the child understood the word hot and realized that, oh my gosh, I almost got burned? No, the child is recoiling because of the tone in mother's voice.
Yeah, there's an alarm. So, I pulled a kettle of boiling water off on myself from when I was still crawling at the time, but nearing 1 year old, and it burned my legs so bad that I learned to walk. So there's a bright side to almost everything.
Yeah. I mean, if mother could say, happy birthday, Christmas, but it's the tone of voice, you know, and the child understands that there is some kind of danger. So it's not until you've grabbed that hot wire from the sparkler on 4th of July, or you've reached into the charcoal grill to get that nice shiny rock, you know, and once you've got your first blister, once you've been crying and you've been burned, all of a sudden for the rest of your life, now you understand the concept of hot.
That's true.
And teenagers really haven't understood responsibility. They've never had to pay for their own apartment. They've never had to pay for their own, you know, car insurance, whatever. They've never had to deal with the, you know, the government. And most of the most passionate, rabid Second Amendment supporters are people who used to be anti-gun people. Okay. Guns are bad. The only reason to have a gun is to rob a bank or kill somebody. So if you have a gun, you are obviously a potential criminal. And then they get molested. Maybe the woman gets raped. Or, you know, the bad guys break into the home and terrorize you before they leave. And all of a sudden, you've decided that there's a dangerous world out there and you're not going to wait 20 minutes for the police to arrive.
Right.
And you're going to handle this all by yourself. And you go from, you know, sweet Polly purebred to Rambo overnight. You know, and you're looking at 44 Magnums because that's the largest handgun made in America, blah, blah, blah. So it's not until people have suffered until they begin to realize what the cure to the problem really is.
That's a really good set of analogies for explaining that important point. And it is true. It really is.
It's unfortunate that there has to be so much suffering for people to get the point. I think part of it is because they've come to not trust the messenger. And it's not until they find it out themselves. And then by then, a lot of things can be lost and gone.
Well, political correctness has restrained us from teaching our messages as clearly as they should have been taught 50 years ago. I think that's at work, and I think the fact that kids can't get jobs anymore. When my kids were growing up, they couldn't get a job. When I was growing up, I always had two or three. And so you learn a different level of financial responsibility much earlier. I started my first business when I was eight. So that teaches you interaction with other people and interaction with the government pretty quickly when you got money to manage.
Absolutely. And a lot of the people nowadays, they've gone into college, they've taken out these large student loans on the assumption that, well, that's all right, I'm just going to go to college, I'm going to get a really good job, and I'll just pay back the money with the really great job that I get. And, you know, they're being shocked and surprised that there are no jobs.
Right.
Doesn't really matter how smart you are, you know, their jobs just don't exist.
On the Constitution, how did you come to be a constitutional scholar?
Well, I was subjected to that same type of pain that we were talking about. I was working for my computer company in Pennsylvania, and long story short, I ended up owing the IRS $6,000 that I didn't have, and the IRS was making my life miserable, threatening to garner my wages, put a hold in all my bank accounts, and repossess my property. And I was more afraid of the IRS than I was of the mafia at the time. My attitude was that at least if the mafia attacks you, you have the right to shoot back.
Okay.
Now
I've learned that line.
You know, I've since learned that the mafia and the IRS basically are one and the same thing.
Yeah, that's right.
And but anyway, I paid the money to the IRS. I studied the IRS, the 16th Amendment, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and again came to the conclusion that most of what the government does is unconstitutional. And I, like everybody else, was in denial. I mean, that certainly cannot be right. And eventually someone gave me a copy of G. Edward Griffin's book. It's called Creature from Jekyll Island. I read Creature from Jekyll Island and realized that I was completely wrong. The problem was much worse than I thought. And throughout my life, just about the time I say, okay, the government is corrupt and we can do this and we can do that, and then all of a sudden I learn something else to realize, no, the proper problem goes much deeper than that. You know, the enemy that we are fighting is much bigger than I imagine. And I've had some depressing moments in my life where I'm thinking, how am I going to fix this problem? Especially, you know, even 10 years ago. I was one of those lunatic fringe that, you know, oh my gosh, conspiracy theorist Michael thinks that most of what the government does is unconstitutional. Well, I'm not all by myself anymore. You've got the Tea Party, the Oath Keepers, the Occupy Wall Street. You cannot throw a stick without hitting a protest rally these days.
There are a lot of people who have come to a realization, especially since 2008, that things are not what they thought they were. They haven't been right for decades.
That's exactly right.
And people have come, been awakened based on what has happened to them personally.
Yeah.
But there were people who were aware that there was something wrong a long time ago and were trying to ring the bell and draw attention and say something's wrong.
But the hot stove hadn't touched them yet.
Hadn't touched them. Well, yeah. It hadn't touched the listeners. But
right.
People have been trying to point something out, I think mostly through the 20th century, that there was something wrong.
I think that's true.
We took a wrong turn somewhere. But our minds were still in the realm of understanding we had a constitution. Our minds were still
We still presumed that.
We did. There was a lot of presumption going on that we actually had a constitution, and when they took an oath, there was an actual law that they were adhering to, but that's not the reality.
Right. That's right.
We're going
to
come.
How close are we to the bottom of the hour now?
Time? We're there?
Yep.
All right. Michael, we're going to take a break for the bottom of the hour. This is America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. Our guest today is Michael Badnarik. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Promote your business on the internet? The Truth in Focus Radio Network reaches listeners locally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and all across the United States. The shift is on from traditional media to internet marketing. Stay on the cutting edge with your business. Advertise with us today. Email radio at truthinfocus.org. You heard the word, so will they. Email us at radio at truthinfocus.org.
Canyon State Wireless is your hands-on source for design, sales, service, and installation of the best land mobile two-way radio systems. Check us out on the web at canyonstatewireless.com or call us for specific information at 866-458-4772, 866-458-4772. Canyon State Wireless. When you're serious about communication.
To make friends, it's good to meet girl, a sweet little queen who can't run away. It's good to be king, whatever it pays. Excuse me if I have some place in my mind where I go time to time.
And welcome back to the second half of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. This is Amanda Teagarden in studio with my host, Don Wyatt.
You've done it again. That's a great song you picked for the bottom of the hour.
It's Good to Be King by Tom Petty.
And it just happens to be the name of a book.
It is. That's your book, Michael. Why don't you tell us about it?
I wanted to write a book that I could use for the text of my Constitution class. And the original title was Foundations of Freedom. That has since become the subtitle. The example that I use in the book is that, you know, the whole American Revolution was all about property. Prior to the Declaration of Independence, King George owned all of England, owned the 13 colonies, owned land around the world. And after the American Revolution, the king no longer owned it. We did. So the American Revolution was fundamentally about the right to own property. And as I go through my little narrative explaining how unique and revolutionary that idea was, you know, I pointed out that, oh my gosh, we can own land just like the king, you know, is able to do. And, you know, I just mentioned that it was good to be king. Well, since then, I've discovered that Mel Brooks has a movie by that name. I had not seen the movie by the time I wrote my book. So I'm not quoting Mel Brooks. I'm probably quoting someone else who is quoting Mel Brooks.
But that's where the term man's home is his castle. Those kinds of analogies come from that, don't they?
Absolutely. You know, your home is your castle. You make all the rules. You are the unquestioned authority in your home.
Or supposed to be.
You know, the next door neighbor cannot come and tell you what color they should paint the living room wall. Now, your authority is ultimate and absolute, but it's very, very limited. You know, it stops as soon as you get to the walls of your little castle. You're not allowed to go next door and tell the neighboring king what he or she can do. And so we have 310 million kings and queens in the United States. Most Americans don't realize they have that authority. You know, somebody walks in with a badge and a uniform and says, "Hi, I'm from the government. I'm here to help." And right away, most of our fellow Americans are groveling, trying to, you know, be good subordinate subjects.
Well, Christian ethic that almost encourages or imposes that approach to submissive...
submitting to authorities.
Right. And there's some misguided parts to it, aren't there?
It is, and I write a semi-periodic newsletter, and one of my newsletter articles is called An Appeal to Authority. And it points out that when you're 5 years old, you're obligated to listen to mom and dad. I mean, otherwise you have no place to sleep and, you know, you go hungry. You go to school, you got to listen to the teacher. You know, you get a driver's license, you got to listen to the police officer. You get a job after college, and all of a sudden you've got to do whatever your manager tells you to do. And all of our lives we've been conditioned to ask for permission from some authority somewhere. And my response to that is to ask you to imagine that you are walking down the sidewalk in town and someone comes up and they start to choke you. Are you going to defend yourself? Yeah. Did you call the chief of police to get permission? Who gave you permission to defend yourself and fight back? And people look at me, you know, they're perplexed. They never considered that question. It's like, are you trying to tell me that you are smart enough to make your own decisions as to about when you're being attacked and when it's appropriate to use, you know, retaliatory force? Well, yeah. I mean, that's a biological instinct. You know, we are hardwired in our DNA to try to keep ourselves alive. I mean, even if you've never taken karate classes, somebody's grabbing you around your throat and you're unable to breathe, you're going to at least wiggle around. You're going to try to make it difficult for the other person to hold on to you. So if you're able to decide, oh, I don't know, when you can do self-defense, you decide what food you eat, what liquids you drink, maybe you're authorized and smart enough to make decisions about what the government could and should be doing.
Right.
You don't have to be a genius to read the Constitution. It's not written in high-tech, you know, legalese.
That's
I've been able to whittle the Constitution down to 7 words. So, you know, you want the Reader's Digest version. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights basically say, don't hurt me, don't take my stuff.
That's a very simple thing to say.
Well, one of our founders was famous for saying that if men were angels, there'd be no need for government. And
that's right. That was John Adams.
Yes.
And, you know, the whole idea that, well, we have to have these smart government authorities to keep us in line. What? Because you're going to just run out and start robbing banks because, you know, the police take a day off? This usually comes up when in discussions about the drug war.
Right.
As a libertarian candidate for president, I used to tell people the drug war was terrible and evil. It was worse than the drugs themselves. And the first accusation was, oh, you just want to legalize marijuana so you can smoke. And I said, that is untrue. I've never smoked marijuana, ever. I've never smoked a cigarette, ever. And if they made marijuana and heroin and cocaine legal tomorrow, I still wouldn't smoke it or use it.
Right.
I don't avoid those drugs because they are illegal. I avoid those drugs because they mess with your ability to think.
Good point.
And especially as a skydiving instructor, I don't want anything to inhibit or impair my ability to think.
Go back to the founding of this. On this Constitution, you're coming to the point here of what type of government, what type of people our government was originally geared toward. It was geared toward a moral people because it allowed so much liberty.
That's right.
And without a moral people, the justification for adding more laws, more laws, more laws to control what would normally be considered moral behavior or immoral behavior or vices or what they consider anything, that's the foot in the door to an increased tyrannical government, is because now it's for the common good because bad people are doing bad things. So
that's right.
We originally, the intent was because of the kind of people who founded this country and their worldview, it's been stated that our form of government was wholly inadequate for an immoral people. It is only adequate for a moral people. So we, as a country, when we do not hold on to principles, when we do not hold on to a moral compass, the scriptural foundations for truth and right behavior one to another, we ourselves are opening the door for an increased tyrannical government.
Yeah, you not only permit it, but you invite it.
You invite it.
And in fact, isn't that the current Sal Alinsky style of advocacy for radical behavior? Is he likes to create a scenario where the public says, oh, this is horrible, do something, fix it for me. And those fixes always involve increase of government and reduction of liberty.
Which is not to be confused, you know, increased liberty is not to increase licentiousness.
This No. It's not libertine, it's liberty.
Liberty. Yeah.
By the way, for those of our listeners who might be interested in your book but unable to catch one of your presentations, either the one coming up in about 10 days or another one, how can they order it, Michael? How can they get a hold of that book?
They can visit my website, constitutionpreservation.org. We're trying to preserve the Constitution, so it's constitutionpreservation.org. There's a menu item there for the book. You can also request a city. It's not practical for me to travel someplace to just teach five people. And so if you go to my website, request a city, you can ask to have me bring my class to, you know, Des Moines, Iowa, someplace. And as soon as I get a significant number of people from the same city or the same surrounding area, then I can send out an email and say, okay, you've requested it, and I'm ready to travel.
What do you use as your normal threshold for the number of students that it would take to make your class viable for all of its various practical considerations?
Well, the target is to have 25 students.
Okay.
I need to pay for airfare and hotel. I need to reserve a conference room at the hotel. So there are some expenses involved.
Of course.
But I'm flexible. If you've got a group, give me a call. I'm willing to negotiate.
That's good to know. By the way, do you still take silver regardless of what the exchange rate is on it?
I do. The class, the cost of my class is constant. It has been and always will be 4 ounces of 999 fine silver.
Perfect.
999 fine, just, you know, pure silver. And I really don't care whose photo is on one side. I literally have silver rounds with the Dick Cheney's face on it.
Or the stagecoach or whatever.
Yeah, it doesn't matter to me. I mean, the silver will melt down and go into my bullet mold regardless whose picture's on the front.
Is this for the vampires?
So the
vampires.
The Lone Ranger.
You know, who was that masked man? I don't know, but his work here is done. See, now you're dating. Most of your listeners have no idea who we are talking about.
Uh-oh.
The
that's what I thought the William Tell Overture was called for
yeah,
years.
Yeah.
The you're starting out in Oklahoma, so it's quite an honor. We're the first one in the series, and a goal, I believe, if I read this correctly, is to hit all 50 states, and kind of on the domino effect. You start in
absolutely.
One, and then
I have been offering my Constitution class to any group of people that is willing to sit still to listen to me. And earlier, just last year sometime, I got a phone call from Oklahoma, and they asked if I could bring my class to Oklahoma City. Well, the answer is, of course. I mean, anything I can do for liberty, I'm willing to do it. And my question was, well, exactly where will I be teaching this class? And when they told me that I was teaching on the floor of the state house,
you're there.
I thought we had a miscommunication. My question is, where is my Constitution class going to be? And they said, yes, on the floor of the state house. And I was in denial. It's like, oh my God, I couldn't really be that lucky.
Yeah, isn't that great?
And before I even had time to advertise it on my website, I had 3 email messages from people begging me to do the same thing in their state. And it's kind of like I feel really stupid now that I didn't think of it before, but I've created a project that I call Operation Domino Effect. The Oklahoma state legislature is the first domino to fall, as it were, to come and listen to my class on individual rights and private property. And I have already sent, in fact, yesterday morning when the post office opened, I dropped 98 envelopes in the mail. There are 49 other states other than Oklahoma, and each state has a Speaker of the House and a Speaker of the Senate, the President pro tempore. And I have,
except Nebraska, they just got a unicameral legislature, right?
Yes, they do. But there's one state that ends up having
two or three.
so they have two speakers of the House.
Oh, okay.
So they kind of compensate. You know, Nebraska has one. There's another state with three, and so it balanced out. But basically, 98 letters went in the mail, and I was very polite. Explained that. Oklahoma is, you know, sponsoring this event, that I'll be talking about all these fundamental principles that the founding fathers, you know, documented on paper. And I invited them to organize a similar event in their state capital.
Super.
And I might have been, oh, just a little bit smarmy, suggesting that, well, they don't want to let Oklahoma have the only patriotic state legislature. So I was trying to leverage a little bit of peer pressure to the event.
That's a good thing.
So I'm very excited. If I can get 10 state capitals in 2012, I think we'll be well on our way to actually restoring a constitutional republic.
That would make a big impact, wouldn't it?
Michael, I want to ask you a question. Do you think that, that when you're speaking of the Constitution, you mean the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and all the amendments, right?
Well, yes. Technically, those are the documents. I usually don't have time to get to any of the amendments beyond the first 10, the Bill of Rights. And sometimes I have to breeze through the Bill of Rights faster than I would like. But what is more important than the Constitution itself is the philosophy, the understanding of principle behind it.
Right.
Who has all of the power? We, the people, wrote and ordained the Constitution. We are the source of all political power. We created the state government, and the state governments got together and created the federal government.
Right.
As kind of a co-op for the things that, you know, there's no reason to have 50 armies and 50 different post offices. And so, you know, when you get with your friends, you know, you don't want to buy the entire cow. And so you join up with your friends and you purchase a cow jointly, right, to make it more efficient and practical for everybody. Well, that's the purpose of the federal government, to provide service that each of the states may not be able to do as efficiently all on their own. But we, the people, are the source of all this power. We can eliminate the federal and or state governments if we so choose. And that's what the Declaration of Independence means when it says that we can alter or abolish.
That's right.
The government.
Let me ask you a question, your opinion here in your examination of this. Have you come to a conclusion or an opinion one way or another if the Constitution, if the parts of the Constitution are severable?
Well, yes. If we can eliminate the Constitution and start over, then yes, of course they're separable. If I'm the carpenter that builds the house, can I tear down part of the house and build a different addition? We have absolute ultimate authority to make the government the one that we want it to be. And in the Declaration of Independence, it says that when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right and their duty to throw off that government and provide new guards for their future security. Well, so not only do we have a right to change the
government. We have an obligation.
We have an obligation,
right.
A moral obligation to change the government if the government has become tyrannical.
Well, I think maybe I didn't say it clearly enough. It's severable in that where you could sever or excise one part or not follow one part of the Constitution, is the remaining part of the Constitution
still valid?
Still valid.
It depends on who you're talking about. We, the people, can alter it, which means we can sever part of it and say, okay, we're not going to follow that part anymore.
Right.
Or we can get rid of it completely, which we've done once. Most of your listeners are at least familiar with the concept of Articles of Confederation. They may not realize the Articles of Confederation were the first Constitution.
Right.
And in 1787, we threw the Articles of Confederation away and wrote the Constitution.
At a convention that was agreed to be an amendment or repair to the Articles, right?
Right. They were supposed to modify the Articles of Convention. They didn't. They threw it away, and they came up with a completely new plan, which was unconfederational.
Right.
But the preamble to the Constitution explicitly says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. More perfect than what? More perfect than the Articles of Confederation we just threw in the garbage.
Exactly.
So the Constitution that we're talking about is number two. And if we could throw away the Articles and create the Constitution, then we certainly can throw away this Constitution if it's not working and come up with a third, most perfect Constitution. Well, what would this third, most perfect Constitution say? Well, we could put it on a 3x5 index card. Don't hurt me. Don't take my stuff. Or I'll shoot and kill you.
The question I have, again, this kind of follows with the idea of severability. Oklahoma Senate has two senators, Inhofe, James Inhofe, and Tom Coburn. Tom Coburn has a reputation of being challenging the earmark process, saying no, holding bills up in committees so that they not be heard. He made a observation to an Oklahoma constituent saying that functionally two-thirds of the Constitution is gone. Functionally. Would you, now that's somebody who's in Congress and has been there for several years now and served two different offices, by the way. What do you say to a comment like that? His inside observations, two-thirds of the Constitution is functionally gone.
Well, I would say that most of the Constitution is functionally gone. If most of what the government does is unconstitutional, there is no functioning Constitution. It's something that people go and visit when they visit this, you know, Smithsonian Institute and the National Archives. But as far as a practical threat, no. I mean, it's gone. And we need to reestablish it. Now, I don't know how to answer your question. We, the people, can do anything we want. We can burn the Constitution, shred the Bill of Rights, and we have the authority to do that. Congress, on the other hand, has no authority to modify the Constitution. They can't decide that they are just going to arbitrarily, you know, well, we're going to adopt this because we think that would be a good idea.
Yeah, and that, boy, is that done all the time, isn't it?
And the reason, people will ask me all the time, how does Congress get away with this? And my answer is always, because you let them do it.
Well said. Yeah.
They had a million mom march to try to eliminate the Second Amendment. If we had a 5 million gun march, you had 5 million people in Washington, D.C., cock locked and loaded, I guarantee we would catch their attention. All this communist country that we've currently got right now would come to an amazing quick halt.
States' rights.
I hate that phrase. I don't hate the concept. I just hate that particular phrase. And the reason is because that it's misleading. I also hate the phrase constitutional rights. I don't like that because if you say it over and over again, it gives people the impression that your rights come from the Constitution.
Good point.
If your rights come from the Constitution, if the Constitution gives you your rights, then the Constitution can take your rights away. And my rights are inherent. You want to burn the Constitution? You want to shred the Bill of Rights? Go ahead. But you're not going to get me to give up my freedom of speech. You're sure not going to get me to give up my guns. My rights are not predicated on a piece of paper. My rights are predicated on whether I'm willing to stand up and defend them. So we individual people have rights. We give certain privileges to the state. And those state powers are privileges, and we can take those privileges away anytime we're, you know, courageous enough to do so.
Do you, in your own mind, Michael, also take the next step and say that those rights are not only inherent, but they are inherent because they are endowed by the Creator? Or do you, is that not as important in your world?
It's not as important in my world, because if I'm talking to somebody who is an atheist, for example, I mean, I could give him all of the references in the Bible that I want, but those references are going to be invalid from the atheist's point of view.
So your approach takes that issue essentially out of the argument.
Yeah, I just don't argue it. I'm not saying that your rights do not come from a creator. I just don't go there.
Okay.
You know, if you believe that your rights come from the creator, okay, I'll back you up. It doesn't matter where they came from. The fact is that you have those rights. You know, if either God does or does not exist. If God does exist, that's where your rights came from. If God doesn't exist, well, then your rights had to come from someplace else. But, you know, to me, it's not from a piece of paper. It's from my willingness to defend those rights. Where does my right to life come from? My right to life comes from the fact that when somebody walks up to me on the sidewalk and starts to choke me, I will poke them in the eye, kick them in the groin, and do what I can to put them in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I will utilize whatever physical violence is necessary to stop the attack.
The logical benefit of your approach, I will say, is that it immediately imposes responsibility on the owner of those rights.
Absolutely.
In other words, the right can't be defined without defining the responsibility to defend it.
That's correct.
Which comes back to the responsibility of
right.
a moral people.
Right. That's right.
Yes.
Very good.
All right. One more time, your website where they can find your book and find out about Operation Domino Effect.
It is constitutionpreservation.org.
And the title of the book is Good to Be King, and we're not referencing a Mel Brooks movie.
or even the song.
Or even the song. It's about property and inherent rights and in defense of the Constitution. And again, the class that's going to be held in Oklahoma City is on Saturday, January 14th, 2012. It's the first of hopefully many classes across this country held in that will be held on the floor of the Oklahoma House of Representatives on a Saturday. Our session starts the first week of February, so it's good to get this groundwork laid before they start.
Right.
Hopefully we'll have a lot of legislators in attendance, and if not, constituents will be in attendance and they can...
There's a lot of preliminary meetings going on down there, so they'll be aware of it.
They will be aware of it, and also your constituent responsibility will also be that you can monitor whether your elected official attended it or not.
That's right, that's right.
So I
took the liberty of mailing a personal letter invitation to each of the members of the Oklahoma State House.
Thank you. Good for you.
I wished them a happy holiday. I explained what the class was about, and I told them that I sincerely hope to see them there.
I will see you there with my 4 ounces of silver.
All right. That's the music indicating the end of this hour of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. We want to thank you for listening and offer may God bless.
¶¶